You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 246, SBL Interviews, Part 1. I'm the layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike, how are you doing?
Pretty good. We're at SBL now.
Yeah, conference number two.
Yeah, I moved a mile or so, changed hotels.
Yeah, it's exciting. Today's been a good day. We've managed to get quite a few interviews. I like this schedule.
Yeah, we're stacking scholars here.
Racking them and stacking them. It's
kind of a grotesque metaphor there.
I sure hope our listeners enjoy them because it's fun to do and a lot of work. So yeah. I hope they get a lot out of it.
Yeah, we have with us today Bill Arnold. Again, he spoke at the Naked Bible Podcast, so we wanted to catch up with him and talk about what seems to me an important new book on Old Testament history and historiography. And then we also talked to Dan Wallace. This is the first time we've been able to get Dan at this event. He's usually much in demand, quite busy, but we want to talk about his CSNTM ministry, where he digitizes Greek New Testament manuscripts around the world. So we catch up with him. We also talked to John Hilber. Again, he also spoke at the Naked Bible Conference this last summer. And we're catching up with John about some things that he's published that, again, to our audience are going to be sort of in the sweet spot. And then lastly, David Burnett, very familiar to the podcast audience, sort of just catching up with him as a doctoral student at Marquette. You know, what the experience has been like for him, stuff he's into, just sort of catching up with him. Welcome to our first day at the Society of Biblical Literature here in Denver. We have a series of interviews, and our first guest is going to be Dr. Bill Arnold. If you were at the Naked Bible Conference or you watched the video, Bill is going to be familiar to you. He's an Old Testament scholar, but I'm going to let him introduce himself a little more fully for those of you who to whom he would be new.
Okay, well, thanks for having me. Mm-hmm. Bill Arnold, I teach Old Testament interpretation at Asbury Theological Seminary. I've been there since 1995.
Wow.
And have enjoyed all these years of teaching and watching young people get excited about the Old Testament and move on into ministry. So
yeah, absolutely.
That's what I do.
And you kind of, you know, you veer in terms of a sort of a specialization to Mesopotamia Assyriology, correct?
Right. Yeah, I like to, in some of my public profile, I like to say that I specialize in Mesopotamian studies or ancient Near Eastern studies and Old Testament studies individually or together.
Mm-hmm.
I'm interested in, as you know, comparative mm-hmm. research,
right.
Comparing, you know, for example, Babylonian law with Mosaic law. And so I like to do them together, but I also love to study them individually in their own right. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah, good. And now today we want to talk about a new book, and I have mm-hmm. the Amazon page up here.
Okay.
Just so I get the title correct. you and Rick Hess, I believe, are the co-editors.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And the book is entitled Ancient Israel's History, An Introduction to Issues and Sources. And so let's start with the subtitle.
Yeah, that's a good place to start.
Because a lot of our listeners, you know, are going to come from the perspective of what issues?
Issues, and, yeah.
You know,
issues,
and the assumption is that the way the Bible, you know, the biblical history is sort of synonymous with Israelite history,
right.
But in the academy, that's not the case.
Mm-hmm.
So if you could unpack that a little bit.
Well, yeah, that subtitle is very intentional. In fact, I was listening as you read it. I had to remind myself what was said there because maybe it would be helpful for the listeners for me to go back to talk about the project in general a little bit.
Sure.
So Rick Hess, a very good friend of mine from a long time ago, started talking about doing this project. I think you're talking to him later this week.
We have
I'm
him
sorry
scheduled.
We couldn't do this together with our crazy schedules. But and when he and the press, Baker Academic, first started talking about this, I said, well, you can't write a history of Israel today. We can't produce a history of ancient Israel now. Mm-hmm. And the reason is because the field of Old Testament studies is in such an absolute state of flux. That's not the right word. It's just, everyone's doing what's right in their own eyes, and there is no solid ground. You can't put your foot on terra firma and say, we're going to establish a history of Israel on this basis. And so I had to, you know, in discussions with Rick and the press, I realized this is really a great opportunity to say, we believe the issues and sources. Mm-hmm. You know, if you produce a book that says these are the issues and these are the sources that you can use to try to address that issue, we're not producing a definitive history of Israel.
Right.
We acknowledge that can't be done in today's world. Now, you're not asking this question, but I'd go back even further and talk a little bit about what's happened in the past 40 years in Old Testament studies, which I know you know this very well, Mike.
But this is something we need to you know, get out.
So it used to be in the old days when you and I were trained, we had certain hard facts, we would call them, that we could lean on to begin to write our history of Israel. And so you had, you know, way back in the 1950s, you had a history of Israel written by John Bright, who argued that you could use archaeology and the biblical text to establish certain facts. And then you could flesh out less secure questions based on that skeleton, if you will.
Yeah, there was a positive symbiosis between those two.
Right. In fact, that, you know, as a student of Albright, he thought archaeology was bringing new things to light, and there was a lot of confidence that you could write a history of Israel in the 1950s. So moving into the 70s and 80s, really at the beginning of what we might call postmodernism, it was clear to the scholarship that Bright and that school had overstated certain facts, certain things, a little bit too much confidence in certain things.
And so the next generation wants to throw the baby out with the
bathwater. Right. Yep. The pendulum swings, you know, from one extreme. Even if I don't call Albright and Bright extremes, but the pendulum swung all the way over now in the 70s and 80s to saying that we can't know anything with certainty about the ancient past, about ancient Israel.
And that's, I mean, our listeners will know that's kind of common across the board in biblical studies. Oh, there's this one thing that scholarship of the previous era overstated a little bit, or maybe got wrong, or, you know, now we have to go in a different direction. And because that we have to fix this, everything needs fixing.
You mean nothing. That's exactly right. Overstatement again.
Yeah.
And ideally you'll come to a point where the, you know, the pendulum spends more time in the middle. So ideally you'd like to find maybe not a compromise, but you'd find that pendulum swinging and you'd find something in the middle that wins the day. And that's not really what's happened. I think there's a convergence in the 80s that led on into the 90s in postmodernism to an extreme opposite of positivism, in a sense, so that the scholarship began to question everything. And, you know, the historicity of David all the way down to there was no northern kingdom of Israel in the 10th century at all, or even in the 8th century.
It's a total hermeneutic of suspicion.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So what we have today, now, fast forward to the present, scholarship has sort of inherited this idea that anything that we might be able to know is from the Persian period, you know, it's or even the Hellenistic, even after Alexander the Great into the Greek period, where you had a few Jews living around Jerusalem who had to create a pass for themselves.
Right.
So all of this is fictive or fictional, even explaining, you know, how Israel came to be. So Rick and I and the press thought what we need, because, of course, as confessional scholars, we've never bought into that. And we believe that there is a place for archaeology to confirm certain things. So in the 1990s, the Tel Dan inscription was found that mentions the house of David, which made it very, very hard to be so skeptical about the historicity of David.
There's some people that tried really hard.
we explain it away. It's not really talking about David or it's whatever. Or it's forged, some people thought, or argued that it was a forgery, which is nonsense. So there are limits to the skepticism, as William Hallowes said years ago. There are certain limits to the skepticism. And Rick and I believe that if you really emphasize sources, ancient Near Eastern sources, archaeology sources, that puts certain limitations around the skepticism.
Yeah.
Now, the other thing that's distinctive about this book that we tried to do in the definition of the book is to say we believe the Old Testament, Hebrew Bible, Hebrew Scriptures, whatever you want to call them, the books of the Old Testament are sources.
Yeah, and that sounds crazy to anybody watching.
It sounds crazy, doesn't it?
But that is where a lot of scholarship is at. Like, because God's such a big character in this source, this doesn't really count. You know, it's not detached or whatever, you know. It's not objective, which is really, I mean, as you know, it's really inconsistent because if we threw out all the ancient Near Eastern material where you have divine characters, we're pretty much left with nothing.
Nothing. Nothing. A few king lists now and then, but even occasionally they even refer to.
Right.
So, right. Because so part of that extreme skepticism was to say that because the Old Testament is religious, because it has a theological argument to make, it has to be discounted. And some of these scholars in the 90s and the early 2000s were trying to, they said, let's write a history of Israel without the Old Testament. Mm-hmm. Relying just on archaeology, just on comparative ancient Near Eastern texts, and their conclusion was essentially, "What ancient Israel? There was no ancient Israel."
Yeah. It's like a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Exactly right. There was no ancient Israel.
Yeah.
So Rick and I and the contributors to this volume does not take a strong confessional. Not everybody in the volume is a Christian, but every contributor has what I would call a moderate methodological approach that admits that the Old Testament sources are sources.
It's a fair hermeneutic.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think in that sense, it does make a contribution. So we try to say, let the Old Testament be what it is. Sure, it's a theological treatise in some cases. It's not writing a positivistic history.
Right. Like all the other ones.
Right. Like all the other ones. That's right, Mike. So I think it does, you know. So, for example, Rick wrote a wonderful chapter at the beginning that introduces all these topics, talks about this history and why the need for this volume. And then I wrote one, the first chapter is on Genesis, which, of course, there's an awful lot about, if you're trying to write a history, there's a lot you can't say.
Mm-hmm.
But, for example, I made the point in there, trying to rely on some of our training in philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
On the use of logic, to say that there's a spectrum of thought here of proving something. You can say something is possible, or it's plausible, or probable, or proven.
Mm-hmm.
And on that spectrum of thought, you can say, well, it's possible that a rational human being somewhere could believe this to be true. That's possible.
Mm-hmm.
Or it's plausible. Well, rational human people could say there are a lot of reasons why you might think that would be true.
Mm-hmm.
Or if it's probable, then it seems like most of the evidence is pointing in that direction, and we would conclude that it's true. And then for some things, we would conclude are proven. Now, I think as a base minimum, what we wanted to do on certain things like Genesis is to say a lot of these things really are possible, maybe even plausible.
Mm-hmm.
So in the Joseph story, for example, Genesis 37 to 50, Much of the scholarship says there was no history of Israel. There was no Israel in Egypt. There was no, the ancestors never lived there. Jacob's family was never there. And so partly this was written to say, nope, you had Semites living in Egypt. You have the Hyksos. You have Ahmose, the first king of the New Kingdom dynasty, may very well have been the king who did not know Joseph.
Mm-hmm.
This is all very plausible. So there are certain plausible conditions, circumstances that have archaeological support, biblical support, that make all of this story plausible.
So my underlying assumption, I mean, having looked at the book and listening to this, is that each essay is going to do some of that. In other words, that's an orienting point.
Right.
This sort of rank of probability, plausibility.
That's good, yes.
Yeah.
They don't always use that terminology necessarily,
but they're going to land somewhere in that spectrum.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
And there's a wonderful chapter by Samuel Gringas who looks at all the ancient Near Eastern treaties and looks at Deuteronomy, for example, and says, you know, they were aware of these other treaties and covenants of the ancient world. This all fits in. It makes plausible sense.
Yeah.
You know, if you're just objective and will allow these sources to speak for themselves, then we don't have to be so skeptical about the history of Israel.
I once said in a doctoral seminar that I thought every graduate student in biblical studies should take a class in logic.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I didn't
really win many hearts and minds.
Well, I'm with you on it. I think that's exactly right.
I mean, it's about framing a question and then again doing exactly what you just laid out. What's possible, probable, plausible, that sort of thing. That's a reasoned way to approach a problem, as opposed to this like all or nothing sort of thing that's been going on.
Yeah.
So, well, I think this book is going to be really helpful. I mean, a lot of our audience is obviously interested in the Old Testament. And if you want to get a book that introduces you to the reality that in the academy, the Bible's not the only source for the history of Israel, and then you have this debate about whether it even is a source, this is the book to get, because it'll help you navigate that terrain and then go down and, you know, drill down into specific eras and topics within the Old Testament story. So thank you
for saying that. That means a lot to me. I'm glad you like it.
Oh yeah, absolutely. So thanks for being
here.
And
I hope when you interview Rick, he doesn't say anything that contradicts what I just said.
If he does, I'll point that
out. Yeah, send him to me. I'll listen. I'll be listening, Rick.
Okay. You bet. Thanks.
All right, thank you.
Well, welcome back to the Society of Biblical Literature annual meeting. We have with us Dr. Dan Wallace, and I'm sure his name will be familiar to a lot of people in our audience. But again, some people might not have heard of Dr. Wallace, so I want you to introduce yourself a little bit first, Dan, and we'll get into what we want to talk about.
Oh, okay. Thank you for letting me be on the show.
Sure, Mike, absolutely.
I am a professor of New Testament, a research professor of New Testament studies at Dallas Seminary, and I also have my own organization, the Center for the Study of New Testament Manuscripts, which has as an initial goal to digitize every single Greek New Testament manuscript in the world. And that's just the initial goal.
That's ambitious. Yeah, the initial goal is ambitious. Yeah,
it's great job security for me. So
yeah, there you go.
In 16 years, we've already photographed 500,000 pages.
Wow.
20%, one-fifth of all the manuscripts.
Wow.
So
what's your background academically?
I went to prepare you for that kind of work. I went to Biola University, where I studied under Harry Sturz, for textual criticism and Greek grammar, and I got several years of Greek under him. He was one of E.C. Caldwell's students. Caldwell was the president of Claremont and one of the most respected New Testament textual critics of the 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
And then after a while, I went to Dallas Seminary and got a master's degree with a triple major, double New Testament, single Old Testament. And studied under Zane Hodges for mm-hmm. textual criticism. I did not agree with his viewpoint.
Right.
But still, it was interesting to get the full on majority text view. Then I got my doctorate at Dallas also and worked especially in Greek grammar. I actually wanted to go to Princeton Seminary and study under Metzger. In 82, and he told me that he was at the retirement age, being forced out, was not allowed to take any more students. So that, ironically, dictated the direction of my studies. If I was going to go to Princeton, I'd work in textual criticism.
Mm-hmm.
If I was going to work in Greek grammar, it would have to be Dallas Seminary because of Buist Fanning.
Right.
But now I've gotten back into textual criticism and still working in Greek grammar.
Wow. Now, you did some postdoctoral work as well, right?
Yeah. I've had postdoc studies at Cambridge University, Tübingen University, and several institutes throughout the world. I spent 3 months at the National Library of Greece. That was just in 2015, but I've probably spent altogether about 10 months at the National Library of Greece in Athens and other institutes throughout the whole world.
What was your postdoctoral pursuits that was oriented to textual criticism, correct?
Yes. All of it was. The Cambridge was kind of a combination. The first Cambridge time was a combination of textual criticism and Greek grammar, but the other times primarily textual criticism.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, that background, it shouldn't surprise anybody listening that Dan is sort of a preeminent name in both of these areas, both Greek grammar and New Testament textual criticism. But, you know, we could spend lots of time on your books and all that sort of thing. And I
spend a lot of time on those books.
I know, but like anecdotes. And I'll just throw one in here. I was a student at Dallas for a year. And I got to see, I believe it was a debate. I believe Pickering was there, or it was a review of Wilbur Pickering's
book.
It
was Pickering. You were at the debate?
Yes, I was there for that. And it just left such an impression on me because I thought, okay, you know, like here we have the majority text view. I mean, somebody who's really invested a lot of time in this, but I'm not trying to say this harshly, but you basically demolished You were quoting references like page numbers and line numbers from reference books and things like that. And I thought, okay.
It was a 3-day debate, and it was the first debate I was ever in.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
I've been in 7.
Wow.
3 of them with Bart Ehrman, 1 with Pickering, and 3 others.
Yeah. Well,
I'm not a debater. That's not my forte.
I'm not a big fan of them either. But that one, I've only probably seen two or three, and that one just really left a distinct impression on me as far as the data. Let's focus though on your nonprofit work, you know, digitizing manuscripts. So how did this begin? I mean, where did the idea come from? Let me mention
a way for people to remember the organization's name.
Okay,
this might be helpful because we have a website. And it's csntm.org. That's a mouthful. But if you know who C.S. Lewis is, you've got the first two initials.
There you go. There you go.
And if you've ever watched Wizard of Oz, you know who Auntie M is.
Auntie M is.
C.S. Auntie M. You won't forget it. It's silly, but you won't forget it.
No, it's embedded now in my head.
Yeah. Hopefully it's not a terrible picture.
Right. So how did this start? I mean, when did you get the inkling to do this?
It was in the late 90s when I started to notice two things. Two things were beginning to develop. One was digital photography. It was still very much in its infancy.
Mm-hmm.
But also the use of optical character recognition that had been developed since the 60s for taking printed text and converting it into Braille.
Mm-hmm.
OCR was used that way. But then in the late 90s, you got things like the Palm Pilot and the Apple Newton, where you could handwrite on the screen. You could still do that on certain devices, and it would convert it to printed text. And when I saw that, I thought, we could do this with Greek manuscripts.
Mm-hmm.
Any alphabetic text should theoretically be able to use OCR. So the combination of the digital images with OCR is what got me to start thinking about this. And the OCR still has a long ways to go before it can do this properly. But the reason this is so important is because we need to get a complete database of all the Greek New Testament manuscripts. One book has been completely done that way, and that was the Book of Revelation. Hermann Hoskier examined every single manuscript that he could locate, which was like 80% of them, so mm-hmm. there were still quite a few more. He went throughout the world. This is back in 1899 to 1929. He did all this work. And he published a two-volume work that gives every single textual variant in every single Greek manuscript.
Wow.
30 years of work for the book of the New Testament that has fewer manuscripts attesting it than any other book. There have been others that have been done. Jude was done by Tommy Wasserman. He did it on all continuous text manuscripts just for Jude. And that took him 6 years. So as I'm wrestling with all this, I'm thinking if we can combine digital images with OCR and have this basically be machine readable and get a very high percentage of accuracy, we could save about 400 man hours of work.
Mm-hmm.
And so with 20% of the manuscripts already digitized, it's not even possible. If you took 10 humans, it's not possible to
right.
go through those in a lifetime.
Is OCR at the place yet where it can reproduce like minuscule, you know, cursive? Because I mean, you can put your signature on things and it'll reproduce that.
Yeah.
Does that work well? Or
it actually is working. I think about as accurately as English, the cursive. The difference is that you've got hands that change over a 1500-year period from the New Testament till the time we get to the printing press.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, every century there's going to be some minor differences. So what we're going to want to do, and again, this is down the line, but what we're going to want to do is plug in, okay, this is 12th century minuscule. Read the text out because there's ligatures, combinations of letters.
Right. You could create typologies then.
Exactly.
Like Cross did with the Dead Sea Scrolls.
Yeah.
And he did all that by hand.
Yeah.
Boy,
I've gotten feedback on this, negative feedback, saying, you can't do it because OCR is only 95% accurate, and the Byzantine manuscripts, all the manuscripts agree about 95% of the time. Okay, let's assume that that's true, and it's very close to the truth. At an individual verse, it's not that way. At an individual verse, you might have three more words or three fewer words or three different words. That's a whole lot different from 95% agreement.
Mm-hmm.
And so most of the verses, not going to be much difference, maybe a few spelling differences, but the ones that do make a difference, this is where OCR is going to really shine, and it's going to help us. We're mm-hmm. we're working on it right now behind the scenes to try to get some decent work done. But in the meantime, we are producing these digital images that even the Institute for New Testament for New Testament textual research
mm-hmm.
in Münster, Germany, is using to produce their Nestle Allen 28 mm-hmm. and the rest of their work. So the standard critical Greek text is now relying on our images.
How commensurate is their work in Münster with their collation efforts, how, I don't want to, up to date's not the right word, but how much of the manuscript data have they accounted for? Or do you just keep running into things that nobody knows about?
In terms of what's cataloged, what scholars know about?
Yeah.
We have discovered approximately 95 manuscripts so far since we started.
That's not accounted for in those.
No, they're up to speed with 74 of them.
Okay.
There's some that they dispute, some that they don't even know about yet, some that they're wrestling with right now.
Okay.
So there may be a dispute, for example, if you have a strip. A manuscript can be the size of a postage stamp, as you all know, working with Old Testament manuscripts. But if you have something that's a binding strip to hold two leaves together in a codex, and it's cannibalized an old majuscule, and they glue it in there, it might be just two letters across, but it might be 20 lines down. We can figure out what that text is. And we can usually date it, too, on that basis.
Wow.
So some of those, they count. Some of those Munster doesn't count, especially the ones that we found in Munster in the manuscripts they had. Hmm. We won't talk about that.
Right, well, no, we can cut that. Yeah, no. So how much time of your year do you spend digitizing? Do you have a team? How do people get on that team?
We have now 7 full-time staff members, 1 part-time staff member. We're growing it. CSNTM used to be in my living room, in my garage, in my closet. Sure. At first, starting in 2002, we would do is go on a 3-week expedition someplace typically in Europe, and photograph manuscripts. We had a budget of about $35,000, and it was pretty amateurish. Since that time, we have developed. We're now on our 7th protocol. We have what's called the Graz Travelers conservation copy stand, which holds the manuscripts in place. It was developed by a professor at Graz University in Austria. And if you want to photograph codices, our modern book form that all New Testament manuscripts are written on, started in the second half of the first century AD, you have to get a Graz Travelers conservation copy stand. Mm-hmm. And on the website, they list the institutes that have at least one of these, like the Vatican and the British Library and the Smithsonian, place like that. And CSNTM has 4. Göttingen University also has four. Nothing else comes close.
Yeah.
So we use that. We use state-of-the-art 50-megapixel cameras. And the staff are all trained. They've all earned their degrees. They've had multiple years of Greek. We've got now 4 people with their PhDs or finishing their PhDs on the staff. Mm-hmm. And they're working in textualism. They earn them at various schools. In order to go on an expedition, someone needs to come to Dallas and be trained on how to photograph these manuscripts.
Sure, yeah.
And the reason is that it takes weeks, maybe a month, to train somebody how to photograph one of these manuscripts properly. Speed is of the essence. I should say efficiency is of the essence, because if you slow us down, it's going to take more time and much more money. Mm-hmm. And so we train teams of 2 people to photograph 400 pages in an 8-hour day, and we allow only 1% of mistakes and 4 pages of mistakes. Mm-hmm. And by a mistake, we mean you cut off the edge.
Right, you got to do it over, yeah.
Or even the ratios of top to bottom, because we shoot against a black background, are not right, or there was a hole in the manuscript, you need to put a white sheet behind it. There's all sorts of little deals here that we're looking for, because we want these to be aesthetically as perfect as possible, but capture all of the details of the images. Mm-hmm. And so when our images now, we shoot where we have the inside of the margin of this open codex, we shoot 1 page at a time, but we bring that over to the edge so that when you visually reunite the 2 pages, it looks like an open book. Mm-hmm. And it's the same size. I mean, we're doing everything exactly the same on either way.
Right.
That takes a good month to learn how to do that.
Yeah.
One guy said, you really can't learn this until you've photographed about 10,000 pages. And that's that's when you're really getting comfortable with it.
Yeah. Okay, well, you mentioned that the cost. So I'm sure the expense is astronomical. So how can people donate?
Well, the good news is, CSNTM is a 501c3, and that means that it's tax deductible. Mm-hmm. And we have donations coming through individuals, even outside the U.S. and foundations. We're even getting secular funding because CSNTM is non-confessional. We don't have any theological commitment whatsoever. And this allows us to get federal grant money. And we really, I mean, we take no political stance anywhere in the world. We run into people that are they're communists or anarchists in Greece. You have plenty of those. And we just say, hey, look, we're just here to do a job. And we are. Mm-hmm. And so that opens up a lot of doors. But people can donate to us by going to the website, csntm.org, and there's a donate page. Mm-hmm. And we really especially need monthly donations, people who will commit at least $25 a month. That's what keeps us really stable going for a long time. Mm-hmm. I should say that to photograph a single unique page of a Greek New Testament costs $11. And that's because of all the travel and hotels and things like that. But for those, starting in 2019, those who have paid for the digitization of a complete Greek New Testament, which is $5,000 essentially, because they're about 450, a little bit larger pages, we give them a certificate for what they've done in terms of preserving Scripture.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Well, I'm glad we could have you today to, you know, just sort of unpack the project. I mean, again, people in our audience may have heard of it, but we appreciate the detail. And again, I would encourage everyone to go to the website, make a donation, even if you can only do it one time. This is a really worthwhile project. There are a lot of things you could give your money to out there that, let's be blunt, are not very worthwhile or not as worthwhile as this. So, Dan, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Mike. I appreciate it very much being on the show.
Absolutely. Well, welcome back to our interview series at the Society of Biblical Literature meetings in Denver. And we have John Hilber with us. Again, if you went to the Naked Bible Conference or you listened to it or you watched it, he will be a familiar face. But many of you, of course, did not do that, and you're new to the podcast. So I want to ask John to introduce himself briefly, and then we'll get into some things that he has produced that you'll want to know about.
Thanks, Mike. Mm-hmm. John Hilbert, and I did my THM work at Dallas Seminary after a stint of the bachelor's in geology. I went the theological route.
I didn't know you did geology.
Yeah, I did. My undergrad at University of Washington in geology. So wow. That had a change of direction there. And wanted to go into pastoral ministry, so I did my THM in Old Testament at Dallas and pastored for 15 years. And then had a midlife crisis, and instead of getting a sports car convertible, we sold everything and went to Cambridge University for a doctorate to prepare for academics.
That's a good trade-off there.
Yeah, I mean, you know, a Corvette, Cambridge doctorate costs about the same.
Right.
So, it's all balancing it. Anyway, after graduation, Dallas asked me to come and teach there. So I was there for 8 years. And then in 2012, went up to Grand Rapids Theological Seminary, and I've been teaching Old Testament studies at Grand Rapids.
It seems like you're enjoying yourself there.
Oh, I am. It's been great. Yeah. You know, we love the community. We love the northern. We're more northern in terms of you know, the temperatures.
I don't miss the winters at all. You know, like the Midwestern winters. But
we love
it. If you're used to that,
This morning, my wife sent me some pictures on text of the snow.
How many inches?
Yeah, the snow coming down. We only probably had three last night or so it wasn't too bad.
Wow.
Three or four.
Well, we want to get into, I'm looking at, you know, what I originally telegraphed you about, because I noticed in the book catalogs that you had something new, specifically a book entitled Behind the Scenes of the Old Testament. So if you could give the viewers, the listeners, an overview of what you're trying to accomplish. I know you have a couple of other editors. What are you trying to accomplish with that book? And you kind of know our audience now, you know, what the sweet spot is. So just describe that a little bit, because we want to, I know it's going to be something, I mean, just having flipped through, I know it's going to be something that a lot of people in this audience are going to want to get.
One of the emphases of our school on the grammatical, historical hermeneutics end of things, we take the historical side very seriously. Mm-hmm. And my colleague, Jonathan Greer, who's one of the co-editors of this volume, teaches the courses that are more backgrounds oriented.
Okay.
And he was frustrated that there wasn't a textbook. So he says, I just need to create this thing. And so Jonathan Greer gave birth to this idea, and he built it around the rubric of of the Old Testament and a drama. So the scenes of the Old Testament alludes to the idea that there's a script that either the texts in the ancient world and there are scenes that is, you know, events in history.
Sure.
And and so it's a bit like a drama. Mm-hmm. And so that's just the rubric that was used to hang on it 66 essays that address pretty much every area of relevance to Old Testament backgrounds. Mm-hmm. Everything from geography, all of the archaeological periods, all the major historical periods. Mm-hmm. There are essays that focus in on particularly really important events, certain battles that made the difference in historical change of things, or things like in Egypt, Akhenaten's monotheism, you know, quote unquote monotheism.
Right,
I don't think it's monotheism in the mosaic sense, but so some essays that focus on particularly important topics that are meaningful historically or thematically. So we have a section on religion. We have a section on daily life kinds of issues. Mm-hmm. I deal with even things of kinship, tribal structures.
So this is a lot. When you say backgrounds, a lot of people will think of, you know, John Walton's, you know, the Ancient Near Eastern Conceptions, you know, that book. But this is a lot wider.
Much wider.
This casts a much wider net.
Yeah. We do have a whole section on scripts, which talks about ancient Near Eastern texts that relate to the Old Testament, which would be more like what John Walton's book focuses on. But this hits about – the only thing that I – as we look back the essays, topics. We don't have anything on maritime culture, meaning how did they do seamanship and how did they do war at sea and how did they do commerce. And in spite of the fact there's a picture of a Phoenician vessel on the front of the cover, we realized we missed something. So, you know, there's some things in there, but 66 essays is pretty comprehensive. The nice thing about them is that we put a word limit at 3,500 words, which means we got about 4,000 words, which translates to, you know, 5 pages of reading.
Right.
So you get condensed from, I should also say that the essays are all written by subspecialists. I mean, not just somebody who kind of specializes in this area, somebody whose current major research is done in the particular area that we are interested in. So somebody who does, you know, Iron Age I archaeology wrote the essay on Iron Age I archaeology.
Right.
And so these essays are all done by people who are on the top of the field. They know the current material, and they're giving you in 5 pages, you know, just the best, most salient issues that are related to that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So who's your target audience? Is it for like an undergrad or a seminary class, or – I would imagine anybody who's interested in backgrounding, you know, this is going to be something ideal.
The target audience was initially upper division undergrad or introductory seminary level. Mm-hmm. Some of the essays turned out being a bit more technical than we had kind of envisioned at the beginning. Some of the archaeology ones, they get into statistical methods and things that can get technical. But for the most part, most all of the essays would be understandable by your audience. Mm-hmm. We don't use Greek and Hebrew stuff that we throw around all the time.
Right, and transliteration and all that.
And John Walton, who's one of the other editors, he's got a lot of experience in addressing wide ranges of audiences. And so we were careful to make sure that we, you know, that we pitched it at a level that, you know, most people in your audience who are serious thinking readers of the Bible could access.
Yeah, well, this sounds really, actually sounds ideal, because when I think of, okay, if I were doing a course on backgrounds, you know, what would I use? And my default has become, you know, Walton's book, but again, that's incomplete. I mean, it's good, but it's incomplete. And then it's like, go to the library. You know, you know, for like Sasson's, you know, reference work, you know, CANE.
Yeah, but that's 2 volumes.
Yeah, I know. You know, you can't like just buy that because it's expensive, and it's probably, I don't know if it's out of print now or what they've done with it. But this does actually fill a gap. I mean, you would think, and maybe a lot of people listening to this would think, well, good grief, everybody talks about this. I'm sure there's like 20 books on. No, there really isn't.
Well, there are 20 books on a lot of different things.
Right. There's nothing that pulls it all together.
Exactly.
And just, I mean, this is a good sort of gateway volume.
Yes.
That you can get started in any one of these, you know, sort of drill down subjects and then go from there.
Yeah.
So that, there was nothing like that.
And
so,
And the nice thing is they're short enough that you could bedtime reading.
Yeah.
You know, 30 minutes of reading each night before bed. And
there you
before
go.
You know it, you're done.
Yeah. Then you're having dreams about it. Well, you have another thing that's forthcoming that is going to really appeal again to our audience, and especially people who, heard, your lecture at the Naked Bible Conference. So tell us about that.
Yeah. Thanks for the chance to sort of pitch this.
Not out yet, but it's coming. It's in the pipeline.
Yeah. At the Naked Bible Conference, you asked me to address the question of literary reading or literal reading of the text. And I'm, as you know, I'm a big advocate of reading the text the way we talk with each other on a normal basis. And that is never assuming literalness of every word you say.
Out of the gate.
We don't assume that. But in fact, we have our minds open to whatever figures you're going to use. And we process all that information simultaneously. And we, at the speed of light, compute what's a figure, what's literal. And we need to read the Bible the same way. And so what I had done at your conference was to address that one slice of the pie from a communication model called relevance theory. And the whole monograph, the book that I wrote, is using the same communication model to ask the question about creation, and in particular the subject of divine accommodation. So that God speaks at the level of the people that he's communicating to.
Sure.
And how does that work so that it doesn't lead us to say, well, there are all these mistakes in the Bible because it's been accommodated to a late Bronze Iron Age culture.
Right. Or we really should be flat earthers, card-carrying members of the Flat Earth Society.
Yeah, exactly.
By the way, they had a meeting this week in Denver.
Oh, no. I missed it. I should have flown in a week early to have taken that in. So the monograph is Old Testament Cosmology and Divine Accommodation, a Relevance Theory Approach.
Yeah, that's going to be excellent.
And it'll be Cascade Books is going to do that, and so it'll be an inexpensive, relatively inexpensive paperback. And the Baker volume is going to be $50 retail, but Amazon you'll get it for $30.
Yeah. Well, I have a feeling that the second book is sort of going to be my go to resource when I get those kinds of questions. I mean, that's just my hunch, because there really isn't anything specific that again would appeal to a general readership, people again who, they have some Bible under their belt, they're good thinkers, they can read academic material. There really isn't anything sort of like that. Again,
there is one other volume that just came out this fall.
Okay,
is it okay to pitch a friend?
Sure.
Yeah, Jack Collins.
Okay,
who's done a number of books already on creation texts. He's got a book just published by Zondervan called Reading Genesis Well.
Okay.
And he goes all the way through from chapters 1 through 11. His commentary just did 1 to 4. And it's a broader treatment of the same question. My book will really tunnel in on one particular sort of communication theory. And it does get technical in the fifth chapter. So sort of buyer beware and warning. The first first three chapters people will be able to track with.
Sure.
And by the time you get to chapter 5, you need to make sure you drank your coffee beforehand. But Jack's book is more broadly addressing the issue of how do you read a text in a literary sort of way. And he tackles the problems like the flood and the Tower of Babel kinds of things, which I deal with Genesis 1 in particular as my model text.
That's good to know that as well. So do you have anything else, other than the two books that we talked about?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked.
Okay.
I have another book as well.
So if the answer is yes, I'm always glad I asked.
Yeah, these things all – there was this weird convergence of three books in one year that, but they've been in process for years. But I've just finished and sent up to Cascade Books a commentary, Ezekiel, a focused commentary for preaching and teaching. And it was initially started.
It sounds a little too practical.
Yeah. I had to.
Why would we want people to preach the text?
I jumped out of the window of the ivory tower, but it didn't go splat. So anyway, thanks. I thank you for asking about that, and I hope
What's the specific, you know, when we talk about the Ezekiel for preaching, what do you do either formatically or pedagogically? I don't know what the right word is here, but how do you, I mean, other than saying, hey, it's in the Bible, it's in the Old Testament, the prophets, don't be scared, you know, preach it. Yeah. I mean, how do you get across exactly how to use the book or how to communicate the book?
The driving value behind this is that each section of text has a main idea. And too often preachers, they don't kind of catch that big idea, and there are a lot of other things that can take you astray. And so nobody wants to be taken out of context, and the prophets didn't either. And so we want to focus on what's the main point that the prophet wanted to get across? What would Ezekiel say if he were living today? And so the authorial intent is not just the theology or the message of the text, but it also has to do with application. And there are some applications that Ezekiel would say, he'd scratch his head and say, well, that wasn't on my radar screen.
Right, right.
And so I'm trying to narrow in on what was the main point of each section of Ezekiel, and what would that look like projected into our world today?
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's important because typically what happens is the Old Testament's avoided. And even if you get in the Old Testament, it's typically Genesis.
Yeah.
If it's wider than that, it's the first five books. You know, but to do the prophets, you know, usually it's people will just pull a verse or two out somewhere of a book like Ezekiel, and that becomes a sermon.
Yeah.
So if you're actually going through the work systematically, again, isolating preachable chunks, you know, in other words, you know, small portions or some, you know, making summaries that are useful that somebody can take that summary and then construct a sermon out of that mm-hmm. that sounds really helpful.
And I preach enough years that I have a sense of what is practical and realistic, both in terms of the extent of the, you know, the comments and also the level of technicality. So there are times when I get into why does the ESV differ from the NIV. A lot of commentaries either jump into the technicalities of textual criticism, but I'm trying at a lay level to explain why did these translations differ at this point so that anybody can understand it and not feel like their confidence in their Bible is to be undermined. So that's another unique feature of this commentary.
It's legit because people could be sitting there with study Bibles. And they're going to have those notes. So, you know, why not explain them?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, exactly. All right. So, again, lots to look forward to. Good stuff. And we're glad that you could spend a few minutes with us.
Well, thank you for having me in.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, welcome back to Denver for the annual interviews that we do at the SBL meetings. We are accompanied by David Burnett. And, again, David's going to be quite familiar to a lot of people who follow the podcast, again, but the podcast keeps growing, so he's going to be new to some. So I'm going to ask Dave to introduce himself, and then we want to catch up with him. So, Dave, tell the listeners who you are.
Well, I'm David Burnett.
It's a good start.
That is my name. I am brand new to the podcast.
Oh, you're not.
Just kidding. No, me and Mike go way back. What is it, 14 years now?
Something like that, yeah.
Something like that?
It's quite a bit.
Yeah, and he was my outside reader for my thesis and my master's. I'm at Marquette University. I am a PhD student in Judaism and Christianity in Antiquity, which is basically Bible and then some. And it's a PhD in religious studies, not theology. So do historical critical approach, you know.
Yeah.
I'm coming the sort of middle of my second year. So I have one more semester of coursework and I finish coursework. It has been eating my lunch.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
I'm also a teaching assistant and a research assistant in the theology department.
What do you have to do? What does that entail?
Well, I'll give an example. this semester, I'm taking 3 doctoral seminars, which has more reading than is humanly possible.
Of course.
And then for my teaching assistantship, I'm working with Dr. Julian Hills, who's in our New Testament department. He does classical Greek, New Testament, and early Christian Apocrypha. He specializes in Gospels and early Christian Apocryphal Gospels and such. So he was also on the Jesus seminar. Okay. So I'm his TA this semester, and so he's teaching two intro to theology honors courses and a New Testament overview course. And so as his TA, I'll do a lot of grading, and I'll teach. Mm-hmm. So I've taught about 6 to 8 times, something like that, mm-hmm. so far.
So do you do full classes, or do you just sort of explain what they just heard in class, or
well,
a little bit of both?
If I'm teaching it, I'll have the whole class.
Okay.
So, yeah, I'll take the whole class when I'm teaching.
Some of some schools have I don't even know what they call them anymore. The recitation sections or something like that, where, you know, like the class meets twice a week, and then the third time it's supposed to meet, it's a TA and he takes the questions and, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And goes back over material or
I did something like that this past summer.
Okay.
I worked for Marquette University has what's called the Educational Opportunities Program, our EOP program. And it's for low income students who are first generation college students. Mm-hmm. And we have a scholarship program for them coming in. Mm-hmm. And they'll take 1 or 2 intro classes in the summer before they start their first year to get them prepped. Mm-hmm. And they'll have EOP seminars. So I was a seminar leader for that. Mm-hmm. And which is sort of like what you were just saying, supplemental to an intro class where I help go over the material with them. Yeah. I help solidify it, help them develop good habits, study habits, how to study for exams, mm-hmm. how to write good papers, mm-hmm. yada, yada, yada. So I did that this summer and it was really rewarding. I did 2 classes. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I can do that again, mm-hmm. just because I took German at the beginning of the summer and then had a week off that I went down to Texas, said hi to everyone, then jumped back on a plane and then started teaching that next Monday morning. And then semester started as soon as that was over.
Yeah.
And so I physically cannot do it. You know, it's just overwhelming because I'm doing French this coming summer. So I want to dedicate next summer to the languages or this coming summer to the languages. So I still have in my program, we have 4 language exams to pass, translation exams, 1 in ancient Greek. Classical Greek, and then 1 in Biblical Hebrew, and then the two modern research languages, German and French.
Yeah.
So I finished German with an A, and then I'll do French this coming summer. Mm-hmm. So
everybody has to go, you know, do the same drill, jump through the same hoops and all that. I did not like my French class, but you know,
I really liked my German class.
I had that in high school, but it's like French. It's like, why don't you pronounce most of the letters in your words? You know, it just, it's like, how does that work? You
know? Yeah.
But anyway, you know, you got to do it.
Yeah.
So give us an example of some of the courses that you've taken.
Yeah. Okay. So I've done advanced Hebrew. So we did, and we basically did exegesis of the Psalms, mm-hmm. And some text criticism and stuff like that. I took, apocalyptic literature. Mm-hmm. We just did a survey of intermediary figures and the etiology of different etiologies of evil within the Pseudepigrapha, which was really interesting with Orlov. And my advanced Hebrew was with Dempsey. Then I took, goodness, my mind is fried. I'm running on fumes right now, man. Yeah. So I've taken advanced Hellenistic Greek.
I was going to say, you had to have Greek classes.
Yeah, so we did advanced Hellenistic Greek. So it was like classical Greek. So we did some like Dio Chrysostom and Strabo and all this stuff. And we also had a Corinthian seminar attached to that. Mm-hmm. So a 1 Corinthian seminar, 1 Corinthian seminar. So that was fun. Mm-hmm. With Michael Cover. That was,
did you feel like you were adequately prepared, you know, for,
not for classical.
Okay.
No, it was my first time taking classical Greek.
Okay.
Like I hadn't had Attic in college or grad school. I just did Koine Greek or Kini. I had about 2.5 years, if including like Septuagintal reading class and stuff like that. But I didn't have any sort of Attic. So I was just thrown into the deep end and you just had to kind of catch up, you know?
So Orlov is your advisor?
Orlov is my advisor.
Okay.
Yeah.
So he'll be the head of your committee.
Well, that's still in discussion yet.
Okay.
So we're not really sure nailing that down, but because tentatively I may end up getting Michael Cover and Andre Orlov as co-chairs.
Okay.
There's a couple of my friends who have done the same thing. They're sort of in a similar vein of research, you know, kind of what I'm doing. And it's worked well for them, I think. So we'll cross that bridge when we come to it.
Yeah. But, so when do you have to turn in or submit your topic?
A proposal?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that'll be the first thing I do after I finish what we call DQEs, which is our comps.
Yeah. We called them prelims. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Dissertation qualifying exams.
Yeah.
So we have five of those. On top of all my language exams. So, three of them are in our area and, then two of them are in supplemental areas. So in my area, Judaism and Christianity Antiquity, three of them, basically the way we do it is we arrange it with, the professors we're working with.
Mm-hmm.
So topics that'll obviously like pertain to our dissertation, my dissertation.
Yeah, that's nice.
But yeah. Then, so that's really great.
Yeah.
But then, we're an interdisciplinary program in the graduate school at Marquette, where sort of preparing us to teach wider sort of theology courses and religion courses. So, so for example, in my coursework, I'll have six core classes in Judaism, Christianity, and Antiquity, and then two systematic theology and two historical theology. And so DQEs are very similar. So we'll do three in our area in JCA, in my area, JCA, and then one in systematics, one in historical.
Okay.
So I have to finish those before I can do the proposal. And then, but I mean, I pretty much have an outline of my project already done.
Yeah.
So,
you got drafted to read a paper this year at SBL. Somebody dropped out. So
Someone dropped out. I wasn't drafted per se. I volunteered and they said yes. So yeah, I was initially turned down because,
sounds a little like inviting yourself.
You know? Yeah. Well, no, I mean, I've presented with DePaul within Judaism before.
You're not somebody they don't know.
Yeah. I'm not a stranger, to them, but, you know, when I had submitted my paper proposal this year, it was about like 30 or 40 minutes late because I wasn't paying attention to the Eastern time and still thought I had time. And, you know, coursework, all I was seeing was coursework. So, you know, I was like, I need to come up. Oh, yeah, I got to submit for SBL, you know. And so I thought I made the cut.
That's what calendars are for.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm somewhat organized. I'm sure.
So what's it on?
It's called Sowing Celestial Seed.
Picks up with the other stuff.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, some of the listeners who are more familiar with my stuff will know what I'm talking about.
So,
but it's the full title is Sowing Celestial Seed, early Jewish interpretation of the Abrahamic promise and the metaphor for the nature of the resurrection body.
So do you mention
In 1 Corinthians 15, 35 through 49.
You mentioned if N.T. Wright's in the room, is there a little dig that
he won't like my paper very much. yeah. Well, you know.
So what? You know what?
I don't care.
Yeah.
You know, we already had that out though in 2014.
So like, is that like an appeal to your
4 years ago?
You
know, I've already had
a line. If he's in the room, I'm going to say this.
You know, no, I literally have not thought about him in relation to this.
Just wondering.
I think he may have had a footnote in my term paper negatively, but but you know, and I'm still kind of shaving it a bit, you know, before Sunday morning. I present Sunday morning at the 9 to 11:30 session or whatever it is. But yeah, it was like a 20 something page paper for Cover that I did in the Corinthian seminar. And then, and he helped me edit it. And working with Michael Cover has been a dream, man. He's been so awesome.
Good.
Just learned a ton. I mean, the guy's forgotten more Greek than I'll ever learn, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, so I did the paper for him and he saw some good ideas in it and his editorial sort of comments were really great.
Right.
And in our seminar, we actually did seminar style presentation of our papers and we actually critiqued each other.
It's nice if that actually produces something helpful.
You know, yeah. It was really great. Yeah. I mean, all of us, the guys at Marquette, shout out to Peter Battaglia and Daniel Mueller and all the rest of the crew over there at Marquette. But it was a great class because the feedback was great from the students too. Mm-hmm. I mean, we have some really sharp grad students, and I was very thankful for their voices too.
So
they have a part in this paper.
Well, no, that's honestly, it's the way it should be.
Yeah.
It's
not
the way a lot of grad programs are. But
that's well, I'm telling you, Marquette's been amazing, man. It's everything that we used to talk about it being. Yeah. It is. It's lived up to the hype. Yeah. So,
how about life in Wisconsin?
Oh man! So I've told the story that you told me years ago
About the nickel.
About the nickel on the sidewalk. I've told it multiple times. Of like you going out to the coin machine and dropping it, and you can't even pick it off the concrete.
Next time it hits 30 below, go out and try that.
You know, it hasn't ever got that low.
You're lucky.
In the past year and a half that I've been there, I think the lowest it got last year was like -14 or something.
Yeah. Adequate.
Yeah, it wasn't bad.
Right. That gives you that orients you. You don't need it to get any.
I can't even believe I'm saying it, but I didn't even wear my parka once last year.
Oh, you got to be kidding.
Yeah. I wore like, sweat layers and then like a thick,
sweaters,
like a thick pea coat thing and scarf and stuff and beanie and gloves. And I was good. Man,
you did better than I did.
But so. I have the big old monster parka. I'm ready for Eskimo weather, man. Like I'm ready. Like nothing can touch me. I've got the Sorrel boots and everything. I'm good to go. Like, yeah.
You're adequately prepared.
Oh yeah. Right. That Wisconsin's got, I'm ready.
Good.
I love Milwaukee's amazing. Yeah. I mean, on the river and the lake's gorgeous and the breweries there are incredible. Mm-hmm. I mean,
are you
really good brew?
I mean, I imagine Marquette has a real, well, they would have to have a superior library.
It has a really good library. I mean, it's not, Yale or Princeton or something.
Madison's was quite good. There wasn't much. I mean, it had a good Second Temple collection, but that they don't have a program in that. But Marquette more or less has programs in all the stuff. So
yeah, I'm pretty happy with our section, but our ILL is really great there too. So I mean, it's real fast. I mean, books that we haven't had, I've got relatively quickly. Right. So the librarians are very good. Our research librarian for the theology department has been incredibly helpful to me, and honestly, I haven't used it too much because I have a pretty big digital library but I have had to put in for certain monographs I haven't been able to get a hold of or something. Yeah. But yeah, overall the library is pretty good.
Well, it sounds to me like you're having it's been a good experience.
Oh man.
Everything we hoped it would be.
Yeah, it was. It really was. I mean, it is, I love the faculty there. They're very supportive. The administration is wonderful. In our department, shout out to Josh Burns, our DGS, our Director of Graduate Studies. They've just been incredible. I mean, so helpful. They helped orient, sort of move around some classes for us, for me and two other guys in my cohort that are JCA, that needed like a gospels course. So they like rearranged classes for us. And Dr. Hills is doing history of the synoptic tradition next semester, which we're really pumped about. So they'll do stuff like that, to help us out with what we need.
Yeah.
I'm telling you,
I'm sorry, but I can't,
it's not a hiccup.
I can't relate to that. But
well, I'm seriously counting my blessings because I try not to take it for granted. I'm very thankful for Marquette, and it's a stellar program. Mm-hmm. And one of my Baylor buddies, this is not me saying this. I'm biased, okay? But one of my Baylor buddies was talking to me last year at the conference and was like, yeah, we were telling some of our guys, if you want to do Second Temple, go up to Marquette, And I'm like, yeah, come on, come do it.
Well, thanks for getting us caught up. A lot of people, track with the podcast, they know who you are. They're interested in what's happening to you, your career. So yeah, thanks for spending some time with us.
Yeah. My pleasure. Always.
All right, Mike, another great set of interviews. I enjoyed all of those. It's always good to catch. We talked to Bill and John about the Naked Bible Conference, and we got a lot of good feedback from them. So that's exciting.
Yeah, they were, I could tell, they were just sort of, it was kind of like shock and awe, just the atmosphere. Again, I think I commented on the blog or a podcast or something. They felt like rock stars for a day. So they all really had a good time.
Can you imagine if Naked Bible becomes popular with the scholars as well as the lay people? That's going to blow my mind if we walk through here. They
start, yeah, really.
No, but great interviews. All right, guys. Well, we appreciate you listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.